Chapter 12. Dynamic Earth, Permissive Ecology. Supercontinental breakup, globe-swaddling ice, rising oxygen levels, and short-lived environmental perturbation at the Proterozoic-Cambrian boundary, great events in Earth's planetary history framed the early evolution of animals, generating successive waves of permissive ecology that fueled metazoan diversification. For more than a century, paleontologists have scrambled across rock faces in search of early animals. Until recently, however, we've labored alone. Other scientists had their own problems and their own agendas. Now, as already heard, paleontology has found an ally in molecular biology, and another partner, equally important, has emerged from our traditional home base of geology. Increasingly, Earth scientists are working to understand how rocks, life, air, and water interact to produce the environment around us. Much of this research, christened Earth System Science, is motivated by concerns about our environmental future, but geochemists and climatologists have also begun to study Earth's environmental past, allowing us, for the first time, to link early animal evolution to late Proterozoic and Cambrian environmental history. And what a history it is turning out to be! In Spitsbergen, the fossil-packed cherts of the Academiker Breen group are separated from younger Cambrian rocks by thick beds of tillite, the coarse and poorly sorted sediment deposited by glaciers. As observed in Chapter 9, tillites also occur just below the extraordinary Daoshantuo fossils of southern China. And in Australia, glacial rocks lie just beneath the thick sedimentary pile that contains Ediacaran fossils near its top. The same stratigraphic pattern can be found in sub-Himalayan India, in European Russia, in Norway, Namibia, and Newfoundland, in the Rocky Mountains, from Death Valley to northern Canada, even in Boston Harbor, figure 12.1, ice heralded the age of animals. Brian Harland, the same Brian Harland who invited me to work in Spitsbergen, was the first to recognize the implications of these widespread tillites, proposing in 1964 that Earth experienced a global ice age near the end of the Proterozoic eon. We tend to be impressed, and rightly so, by the fact that 18,000 years ago, Boston and Chicago lay beneath glacial ice, but Pleistocene ice sheets never extended south of Long Island, even at the height of glaciation, leaving much of North America ice-free. In contrast, if Harland was correct, most land masses on the late Proterozoic Earth must have been covered by ice. Decades of careful research have confirmed Harland's proposal. In fact, continental glaciers spread across the globe more than once, although the exact number of late Proterozoic ice ages remains contentious. Noting that only two tillite successions are found in most regions, some stratigraphers believe that Earth froze twice. On the other hand, applied to Phanerozoic rocks, the same approach would suggest that our planet endured two ice ages in the past 500 million years, when in fact there were three. Only precise radiometric dates can solve the problem. My own view is that Earth chilled at least four times during the late Proterozoic, an initial event a bit earlier than 765 million years ago and arguably confined to Africa, two truly global ice ages, 710 million plus or minus 20 million years, and a bit more than 600 million years ago, and at least one last, relatively small, hurrah before the Cambrian began. In general, sedimentary geologists associate glacial rocks with cold climate and carbonate accumulation with warmth, but as seen in Spitsbergen, late Proterozoic tillites commonly lie sandwiched between carbonate-rich successions. In particular, late Proterozoic glacial rocks are nearly always capped by distinctive carbonate beds that display unusual sedimentary features, including sheaves of slender crystals like those found in Archean and earliest Proterozoic limestones, figure 12.2. In many places, you can place a knife blade at the sharp contact between glacial rocks and the blanketing cap carbonates. Our research in Spitsbergen turned up another unusual feature of these cap carbonates, in this case a chemical oddity. Recall from chapters 3 and 6 that two different types of information can be gleaned from carbon isotopes in sedimentary rocks. Differences in the isotopic compositions of limestone and organic matter reflect the metabolisms of organisms in the local ecosystem. On the other hand, the absolute ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12 in limestones and dolomites allows us to estimate the relative contributions of carbonate and organic matter to sedimentary carbon burial at the time the rocks formed. Higher C isotopic values imply higher rates of organic carbon burial, figure 6.6. Thick carbonate successions below late Proterozoic glacial rocks generally have unusually high C isotopic ratios, nearly matching the extremes found in 2.4 to 2.2 billion year old rocks and exceeding anything else seen in the geologic record. In contrast, the C isotopic compositions of cap carbonates fall to extremely low values. This chemical pattern occurs not only in Spitsbergen, but worldwide, with an additional twist discussed later. Moreover, it applies to each major ice age. Late Proterozoic ice ages, thus, can be linked to unusual behavior of the global carbon cycle. How do we explain these chemical fluctuations, and what do they tell us about the late Proterozoic world? Geology helps to explain our isotopic data. The onset of unusually high C isotopic ratios coincides with the rifting and breakup of one or more late Proterozoic supercontinents. As great continents broke apart, narrow seas opened, perhaps facilitating the burial of organic matter in rapidly accumulating sediments. That is to say, tectonic changes may explain the chemical observation of high C isotopic values. High rates of organic carbon burial may in turn have helped to keep atmospheric CO2 at relatively low levels, cooling global climate and leaving the Earth vulnerable to glaciation. The intricate linkage of Earth and environment implied by these relationships is what Earth system science is all about. The low C isotopic values in cap carbonates have been interpreted in several ways. One possibility is that algae and cyanobacteria were scarce in the post-glacial ocean, and the burial rate of organic matter correspondingly low. Another is that cap carbonates accumulated at extremely rapid rates, swamping any influence of organic carbon burial on the C isotopic record. We might also conjecture that as glacial ice retreated, methane, which has very low C isotopic values, was belched from the margins of warming continents. There's more. Conspicuous carbonate precipitates were not the only archaic sedimentary features reprised in association with late Proterozoic glaciation. Iron formations returned as well. As documented by Grant Young, a geologist at the University of Western Ontario, iron formations occur among late Proterozoic tillites throughout the world, especially those formed during the Great Ice Age circa 710 million years ago. We explained earlier iron formations as the products of dissolved iron transport in deep oceans that lacked oxygen or sulfide. How could such oceans return more than a billion years after they disappeared, seemingly for good? We will return to the question of ice and iron, but there is one more aspect of late Proterozoic glaciation that requires attention, because it may provide the key to everything else. At least some tillites formed at sea level near the late Proterozoic equator. This was not your Cro-Magnon ancestors' ice age. How do we know this? Given that continents have migrated through time, rafted by tectonic plates, how can we tell that rocks formed deep in our planet's history accumulated in the tropics? The answer lies in the magnetic properties of sedimentary and volcanic rocks. When rocks form, iron-bearing minerals crystallize in alignment with the Earth's magnetic field, Frozen in place, this magnetic orientation can be preserved through geologic time, enabling geologists to determine the latitude, but not longitude, at which ancient rocks originated. Magnetic orientation can also be reset by later events, so geologists must be exceedingly careful in interpreting paleomagnetic data. Meticulous studies of glacial rocks in southern Australia and western North America show that these beds formed within 10 degrees of the late Proterozoic equator. At circa 40 degrees paleolatitude, the Nantou tillite in China is among the most poleward of the admittedly few tillites whose magnetic signatures have been reliably measured. In 1992, Joe Kirschvink, a gifted maverick in Caltech's geology department, painted an extraordinary picture of late Proterozoic ice ages. According to Joe, glaciation may have begun conventionally at high latitudes or elevations, but as ice sheets expanded toward the equator, Earth's climate system approached and then crossed a critical threshold. Ice reflects sunlight back into space. In the language of climatology, it has a high albedo, cooling the planet as it expands. Cold, in turn, facilitates further glacial growth. Thus, there is a positive feedback associated with waxing ice sheets. In Kirschvink's view, once glaciers expanded to within about 30 degrees of the equator, runaway refrigeration ensued, covering the Earth with ice in as little as a few thousand years. Ice sheets stretched from pole to pole, and sea ice blanketed the oceans, forming, in Kirschvink's evocative phrase, a snowball Earth. At first, few people took Kirschvink's proposal seriously. For one thing, it required that we set aside accepted models based on Pleistocene climate in favor of a radical alternative, a move rarely favored by innately conservative scientists. Moreover, the snowball Earth presents a fundamental problem. Once the planet gets into this state, it's hard to get back out. In 1998, however, stock in the snowball Earth appreciated dramatically. During a series of late-night conversations in the Harvard Earth Science Building, geologist Paul Hoffman and geochemist Dan Schrag conceived of a way to reconcile geological observations of late Proterozoic glaciation with Kirschvink's vision of a frozen planet. In particular, they interpreted the geology and chemistry of cap carbonates as evidence for Joe's proposed escape route from the snowball's icy grip. In Hoffman and Schrag's reworking of the snowball Earth hypothesis, late Proterozoic ice ages began, much as Kirschvink suggested, with conventional glaciers that crossed a critical latitudinal threshold and then rapidly covered the planet. The global lid of ice nearly shut down primary production, accounting for a putatively extended interval of low sea isotopic values, which Hoffman and colleagues found begins just below the tillites, at least for one ice age. The icy veneer further prevented oxygen from diffusing into seawater from the atmosphere, resulting in anoxic deep oceans. In the absence of primary production, rates of sulfate reduction also slowed, limiting the production of H2S and, therefore, for the first time since 1.8 billion years ago, allowing iron to build up in oceanic deep waters. Cold and ice also shut down continental weathering. Thus, glacial ice nearly stopped the two principal processes that remove carbon dioxide from air. But ice couldn't stop the main engine by which CO2 is added to the atmosphere, volcanism. As a result, CO2 levels gradually rose in the air above the icy wastes. Carbon dioxide is an important greenhouse gas, but Hoffman and Schrag estimate that to vanquish the global ice sheets, atmospheric CO2 must have risen to levels as much as 300 to 400 times higher than today's. It takes time to accumulate such massive stores of carbon dioxide. Hoffman and Schrag suggest several million years, in line with their estimates of glacial duration. But once a critical threshold, again, was passed, deglaciation would have been nearly instantaneous, melting the vast ice sheets, causing a sharp rise in sea level and catapulting ocean temperature to 40 degrees Celsius or higher, much hotter than the warmest seas today. Chemical weathering on the hot post-glacial Earth would have proceeded at record high pace, feeding large amounts of calcium into the oceans, where cap carbonates precipitated. Weathering also would have drawn CO2 from the atmosphere, hastening our planet's return to normalcy. What about snowball biology? If the apocalyptic scenario of Hoffman and Schrag is to be believed, previously productive habitats would have disappeared as ice expanded, eventually restricting most marine organisms to small refuges around emergent hydrothermal vents like present-day Iceland. Then things would have gotten really bad. Having narrowly escaped an end by ice, the biological world would have been scorched by fire, as the oceans heated up to temperatures that few eukaryotes can tolerate for long intervals. Despite this, Hoffman and Schrag suggest that the snowball Earth and its aftermath provided the crucible that forged animal life. This belief rests largely on the stratigraphic appearance of Ediacaran animals above late Proterozoic tillites, but it is bolstered by the suggestion, much debated in genetic circles, that extreme environmental stress can induce mutations that fuel biological innovation. The snowball Earth qualifies as a big idea, taking in a remarkable sweep of climatic history, geochemistry, and biology. Not surprisingly, then, it has spawned vigorous argument, as big ideas usually do. Not all aspects of the debate are germane to this discussion, but as paleontologists, we do need to ask two questions. Did some form of snowball really happen? And if it did, what might we reasonably conclude about its evolutionary consequences? Two issues illustrate, but do not completely encompass, the nature of current disputes. First, there are questions about water during late Proterozoic ice ages. In the original snowball scenario, sea ice, as much as half a mile thick, severely restricts the transfer of water vapor from ocean to atmosphere, slowing Earth's hydrological cycle almost to a standstill. Yet those Australian tillites that formed near the late Proterozoic equator reach a thickness of more than 3,000 feet, telling us that ice sheets must have continued to grow for a long time after glaciation reached the tropics. Given that low-latitude sea ice both begins and ends rapidly in the snowball scenario, it isn't easy to reconcile these tillites with hydrological shutdown. Now we can relent on sea ice thickness and envision oceans with no more than a thin, maybe a few feet, veneer of ice that would crack and break, allowing the hydrological cycle to continue. But if we accept this, we must allow carbon dioxide exchange between air and sea, potentially limiting the hypothesized buildup of atmospheric CO2. A second issue concerns the carbon isotopic record outlined before. Sea isotopic values may be low both before and after ice ages, but in the evolving snowball scenario, they are low for different reasons. Along with graduate student Pippa Halverson and Yale University geochemist Robert Berner, Schrag and Hoffman hypothesized that methane leakage from organic-rich sediments controlled immediately pre-glacial climates. Biogenic methane is strongly enriched in carbon-12, recall Chapter 6, and molecule for molecule, it is far more effective as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Schrag, Hoffman, and colleagues suggest that, in essence, the Earth became addicted to methane for keeping warm, and when for some reason the supply was shut off, temperatures plunged and ice expanded. Note that this proposal can work only if oxygen levels remained low on the late Proterozoic Earth. Today, methane released slowly from seafloor sediments would react with O2 as it ascended through the water column, delivering carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. We'll return to the question of oxygen later. In contrast, Schrag and Hoffman ascribe post-glacial sea isotopic values to super-rapid carbonate precipitation. Because these hypotheses explain pre-glacial and post-glacial sea isotopic values in different ways, they make no prediction about carbon chemistry during the ice ages. Many workers have assumed that sea isotopic values were continuously low through the glacial epoch, hence the hypothesis that primary production fell to extremely low levels. But recent analyses of relatively rare carbonate beds within tillite sections call this assumption into question. Three leading snowball skeptics, Martin Kennedy of the University of California at Riverside, Tony Prave of Aberdeen University in Scotland, and Columbia University's Nick Christie Blick, who once gave a lecture at MIT titled "A Neo-Proterozoic Snow Job," leaving no ambiguity about his views, have systematically sampled intraglacial carbonate beds from several continents. These rocks turn out to have sea isotopic values that are rather normal for limestones and dolomites of any age. It might be argued that intraglacial carbonates formed by the redeposition of older preglacial rocks, but the beds include oolites that must have precipitated from Ice Age seawater. Remembering that the sea isotopic composition of carbonates reflects proportional rates of organic and carbonate-carbon burial, we can conclude either that carbonate deposition plummeted along with primary production during global glaciation, or that primary production didn't drop off so much after all. In fact, most aspects of the late Proterozoic glacial record can be interpreted in more than one way, including the proposed extent of ice cover. Tom Crowley, now at Duke University, has investigated late Proterozoic glaciation using climate models of the type developed to explore 21st century global warming. In his models, ice sheets spread rapidly once they reach a paleolatitude of 30 to 40 degrees, and sea ice expands to cover much of the world's oceans, score one for the snowball Earth. But unlike the full-tilt snowball scenario, some iterations of Crowley's model leave extensive areas of equatorial ocean ice-free. Another difference, Crowley's ice begins to retreat when atmospheric CO2 reaches a modest 4 to 5 times pre-glacial levels. Who is right? Nobody knows, in part because we still lack observations or measurements that might help us to choose among competing plausibilities. I like many features of the snowball hypothesis. Nonetheless, I confess a preference for milder slushball variants of late Proterozoic climatic history, versions that begin and end less catastrophically and leave a bit of open water in the oceans, because I find them easier to reconcile with what I see in the field, and because they don't require ad hoc assumptions to explain the survival of diverse eukaryotic organisms. Bacteria and archaea are less informative because, as outlined in Chapter 7, prokaryotic taxa are hard to eliminate under almost any circumstances. The final chapters in snowball research have yet to be written, but we know enough to be clear on what is probably the key point in all of this. Even in the mildest permissible scenarios, ice covers much of our planet's oceans and most of its continental shelves. No resolution of the current debate will restore the comfortable idea that late Proterozoic ice ages were like the Pleistocene, only older. Late Proterozoic glaciation was extraordinary, and it must have left its mark on contemporary biology. In Chapter 9, we discussed the early fossil record of eukaryotic organisms. Red algae appeared well before the onset of late Proterozoic ice ages, and so must have survived the vicissitudes of both glaciation and deglaciation. Green algae did as well, along with relatives of brown algae, dinoflagellates, ciliates, and testate amoebas. If molecular clocks have any merit at all, even microscopic animals must have weathered some or all of these climatic storms. The list of survivors expands further when we add inferences from the Tree of Life. For example, fossils of testate amoebae in 750 million-year-old rocks require, at a minimum, that the common ancestor of fungi and animals was also present, because the evolution of identifiable characters in testate amoebae must logically have come after the phylogenetic split between this group and the animals plus fungi. In fact, most major groups of present-day eukaryotes must have been present before the late Proterozoic ice ages began. A lot of lineages survived climatic upheaval. This perspective on ice age biology indicates that refuges must have been numerous, widespread, and persistent during the worst of the glaciers, explaining my preference for relimatively mild paleoclimatic scenarios. On the other hand, tabulating ice age survivors doesn't fully address questions about ice age extinctions. After all, while the phylum Brachiopoda survived the great Permo-Triassic mass extinction 251 million years ago, more than 90% of all brachiopod species disappeared. Many microscopic eukaryotes leave no identifiable fossils, so our ability to evaluate the magnitude of ice-related extinctions is limited. Nonetheless, by tracking the records of eukaryotes that do fossilize, Gonzalo Vidal and I observed years ago that many protists failed to survive late Proterozoic glaciation. Climatic shifts did prune the eukaryotic tree. That said, the most conspicuous plankton extinction in the Proterozoic record occurred just after the Daushantuo Formation was deposited, Chapter 9, perhaps associated with one last cold snap, but not in conjunction with global glaciation. Snowball ice was not the only influence on late Proterozoic life. If patterns of extinction and survival allow a range of ice age scenarios, what should we make of attempts to link late Proterozoic glaciers with biological innovation? Research on stress-induced mutations remains in intriguing infancy, but as yet we have little evidence that stress facilitates mutations that lie beyond the realm of more mundane genetic processes, or that these mutations adapt animals for conditions beyond those that induce the stress. Of course, in slush ball scenarios for late Proterozoic climate change, surviving populations need not have been subjected to extremely harsh glacial or post-glacial conditions. Moreover, the numbers of survivors needn't have been small. When organisms are tiny, many individuals can fit into a small area. A square meter of beach sand, for example, can harbor millions of nematodes. The principal influence of global glaciation was probably ecological, regardless of which ice age scenario we choose to favor. Recall the argument, introduced last chapter, that permissive ecology foments biological revolution. The growth of globe-swaddling ice sheets would have removed biology from much of the Earth's surface, and when in due course the ice receded, huge areas of real estate would have become available for recolonization. Successful colonists likely experienced little competition, permitting novel and perhaps poorly functioning variants to survive. Genetic variation is necessary for evolutionary radiation, but is not sufficient. Populations need Lebensraum, where nascent novelties can survive and reproduce. That is just what the decay of late Proterozoic ice ages provided. However, there is a problem. At the beginning of this chapter, I stated that the late Proterozoic Earth experienced at least four ice ages, two of global dimensions. But Ediacaran animals and diverse algae follow only the last ice age. Earlier Proterozoic glaciation did not engender recognizable evolutionary innovations. Ice ages were not magic wands of evolution. We have to ask what was different about the aftermaths of younger and older ice ages. I believe that oxygen made all the difference. In 1959, J.R. Nursel, a zoologist at the University of Alberta, proposed that animals appeared so late in the evolutionary day because only in the latest Proterozoic did our atmosphere accumulate enough oxygen to sustain metazoan physiology. Nursel based his hypothesis strictly on comparative biology. I'm not sure he ever knowingly looked at a Proterozoic rock, Nonetheless, his proposal has enjoyed episodic popularity among paleontologists. Only in the past decade, however, has Nursel's idea garnered empirical support from geology. There is no question about animals' need for oxygen. In modern marine basins, the abundance and diversity of animal species declines precipitately as we approach anoxic waters. Small animals persist better than large. Nematodes and other tiny animals that inhabit the spaces between sand grains on the seafloor have especially low oxygen needs. Heavily skeletonized species fare most poorly. Few armored animals live in oxygen-starved environments. As early as 1919, Auguste Crow showed that when marine animals depend on diffusion to supply their tissues with oxygen, body size is limited by the amount of oxygen in surrounding waters. Crow's biophysical rule can be circumvented in many ways. Animals like cnidarians, and probably the vendobiontids in Ediacaran assemblages, achieve large size by draping thin layers of metabolically active tissue around inert jelly or fluid. Circulation of body fluids and specialized respiratory organs, gills or lungs, help as well, carrying oxygen efficiently to distant tissues. Nonetheless, on the Proterozoic Earth, before animals evolved sophisticated circulatory systems, oxygen levels must have determined the effective sizes of animals. The application to late Proterozoic biological history is obvious. Microscopic animals with scant oxygen requirements could have plied Proterozoic seas long before the Ediacaran epoch. Only with a latest Proterozoic rise in oxygen, however, did macroscopic, and hence easily fossilizable, animals become possible. The oxygen hypothesis reconciles paleontology and molecular clocks, and it explains the simultaneous radiations of animals and algae in latest Proterozoic oceans. Recall from Chapter 9 that only in oxygen-rich oceans would large-celled eukaryotic algae have gained prominence across continental shelves. As outlined before, a latest Proterozoic rise in oxygen also makes Schrag and Hoffman's proposal for methane-driven glacial initiation possible and, if that model is correct, explains why global ice ages never returned in the age of animals. Did any such event leave its mark in the geochemical record? The answer is yes. When John Hayes, Jay Kaufman, another lab alumnus, and I first documented high sea isotopic values in late Proterozoic carbonates, we recognized this as a smoking gun for oxygen influx. As discussed in Chapter 6, photosynthesizing cyanobacteria and algae use carbon dioxide and water to produce both organic molecules and oxygen. Respiring organisms react the organic matter and oxygen back to carbon dioxide and water. So, as long as photosynthesis and respiration remain in balance, the environment doesn't change. Burial of organic matter breaks this metabolic couple, making it possible for oxygen to accumulate in the atmosphere and oceans. High sea isotopic values imply that in late Proterozoic oceans, organic matter was buried at unusually high rates. Indeed, when Lou Derry, Jay Kaufman, and Stein Jacobson used sea isotopic and other geochemical data to model late Proterozoic atmospheric change, they concluded that oxygen increased strongly just after the younger of the global ice ages, supplying an answer to the question of why life responded differently in the aftermaths of earlier and later glaciations on the late Proterozoic Earth. Independent evidence for latest Proterozoic oxygen increase comes from the sulfur isotopic record. In Chapter 6, I outlined the thinking that led Don Canfield to propose that mid-Proterozoic oceans featured moderate oxygen at the surface and hydrogen sulfide at depth. One of Don's key observations was that S-isotopic fractionation didn't reach modern values until the end of the eon. The sulfitic ocean returns here, now, however, seen in its closing moments. Only as the Proterozoic eon ended did sulfur-bearing minerals begin to record the fractionation expected in oceans full of oxygen. Sulfur isotopes also suggest that sulfate concentrations rose to near modern levels at this time, consistent with an overall increase in Earth's surface oxidation level. Thus, geochemistry increasingly supports Nursel's hunch that animal evolution was stirred by oxygen. And with more oxygen, a new world began to emerge. Seaweeds and planktonic algae diversified across continental shelves. Among animals, developmental mutations favoring large body size stopped being lethal and began to be advantageous, introducing new functional possibilities. By 555 million years ago, large size had evolved in colonial protozoans, sponges, cnidarians, and vendobionts, and stem bilaterians. Perhaps there is nothing more to explain. Perhaps, with the genetic toolkit in place, removal of the oxygen barrier simply allowed animal life to unfold. But there is one more event to explore. Namibian fossils demonstrate that Ediacaran organisms reigned over marine communities until the very end of the Proterozoic Eon. Conversely, the Kutuikan cliffs show that bilaterian diversity literally took shape later, as the Cambrian began. Intriguingly, at the boundary between these two faunas, sea isotopic values fall through the floor, signaling a large but short-lived perturbation in Earth's carbon cycle. Around the world, carbonate rocks near the Proterozoic-Cambrian boundary display sea isotopic values as low as or lower than those in the cap carbonates that cover late Proterozoic glacial beds, figure 11.6. However, there is little evidence of tillites at the boundary, nor do we find any of the unusual sedimentary features that mark post-glacial caps. Radiometric dates tell us that the isotopic anomaly came and went in less than a million years, and research on trace elements, especially uranium enrichment, by Japanese geochemists Hiroto Kimura and Yoshio Watanabe, suggests that coastal oceans were transiently starved of oxygen. What could have caused such a perturbation? We don't know for sure, but the candidate list is short, and all plausible explanations imply bad times for biology. Moreover, similar chemistry marks a major event in more recent Earth history, the great mass extinction at the boundary between the Permian and Triassic periods. Permo-Triassic catastrophe has been blamed on great bursts of methane from icy stores on continental slopes, or catastrophic overturn of the hemisphere-scale Panthalassic Ocean, bringing oxygen-poor but CO2-rich waters to the surface. Impact by a meteor or comet also attracts interest, although evidence for extraterrestrial influence on end-Permian extinction remains controversial. The same suspects form the lineup for end-Proterozoic environmental perturbation, but as in the Permian, we don't yet know which party, if any, is guilty. Could mass extinction explain the stratigraphic break and morphological gulf between Ediacaran and Cambrian animals? I think that it can. In fact, marine life across the Proterozoic-Cambrian boundary reminds me a great deal of land animals at another time of mass extinction, the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. Beginning near the end of the Triassic period, dinosaurs dominated terrestrial ecosystems for nearly 150 million years. Mammals shared the landscape for pretty much all of this interval, but remained small and simple. Then, at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, 65 million years ago, a giant meteor slammed into our planet, eliminating the dinosaurs, save for the ecologically distinct birds, but not all mammals. In the ecologically permissive world that followed, mammalian survivors diversified rapidly, giving rise to the major groups of mammals that have graced plains and forests ever since. I like the idea that Ediacaran animals were the dinosaurs of late Proterozoic ecosystems, simple but ecologically effective organisms that held stem group bilaterians in check. When Ediacarans vanished, they left a huge opening for bilaterian survivors. Bilaterian animals radiated in this relatively empty world, filling it with the fauna that still dominates the oceans, permissive ecology coming into play once more, figure 12.3. This argument has been criticized as hard to test. Yes, Ediacaran diversity plummeted at the Proterozoic-Cambrian boundary, but as increased burrowing began to churn sediments in the Cambrian, the preservational window through which we view Ediacaran biology also closed. This isn't quite true, but it is true enough to limit our confidence in interpreting the disappearance of Ediacaran fossils from the rock record. The Burgess Shale and its earlier Cambrian counterparts do afford an opportunity to look for soft-bodied animals. One or two Ediacaran holdovers have been claimed, but by the end of the early Cambrian, Ediacaran-grade organisms clearly played a minor role at best in marine ecosystems. But there is another record to test. Remember that microbial reefs in Nama and other late Proterozoic successions contain abundant and modestly diverse skeletons of early animals. Working in Oman, where the sea isotopic boundary event can be traced throughout a large and well-explored basin, it hosts a giant oil field, John Grotzinger found that Claudina, Namacathalus, and other skeletal fossils occur abundantly in all reefs up to the horizon of the isotopic excursion. The microbial reefs continue above it, but they don't contain skeletons. They are almost eerily quiet, much like sedimentary beds just above the Permian-Triassic boundary. Thanks to John, then, we have positive evidence for a biological change of guard, precisely coincident with environmental insult at the end of the Proterozoic. As the Cambrian dawned, there may have been a moment, in a world depleted by extinction and before genetics had locked animals into particular patterns of growth and development, when all things were possible in animal evolution. Any such moment, however, must have been brief. Guided by developmental genetics, expanding animal populations began to accumulate the biological features we associate today with arthropods and brachiopods, echinoderms and chordates, and with emerging body plans came differing functional possibilities that partitioned the metazoan world and shaped the connections among species. Algae diversified as well in a Cambrian explosion that cut across kingdoms. Physical events may thus have provided the opportunity for Cambrian diversification, but the evolutionary paths actually traveled by Cambrian animals reflect the interplay between development and ecology. Predators and prey locked into an evolutionary arms race, while grazers and algae began to shape the limits of each other's existence. More than ever before, biological interactions, and not just the physical environment, determined the shape of life. And as the world filled ecologically, evolutionary opportunities for further new body plans dwindled. In the seas, the hand that animal evolution would play for the next 500 million years had been dealt. Beneath this new ecological edifice, of course, Earth's age-old ecological circuitry continued unchanged. As they did 3 billion years earlier, bacteria continued to cycle biologically important elements through ecosystems, sustaining the biosphere that made animal life possible. Truth in advertising forces me to acknowledge that some paleontologists tell the story of animal diversification without invoking any environmental influence. In this telling, animals arose only in latest Proterozoic oceans, quickly taking evolutionary shape as the Ediacaran fauna, which in the predatory world of the Cambrian gave way to more sophisticated crown group bilaterians and cnidarians. Viewed this way, genetics and ecology are not just important drivers of the Cambrian evolution, they are the only drivers. The idea that late Proterozoic evolution owes nothing to environmental change has some articulate adherence, but I believe that it flies in the face of everything geology has taught us about both the late Precambrian Earth and more recent evolution. If there is one lesson that paleontology offers to evolutionary biology, other than the documentation of biological history itself, it is that life's opportunities and catastrophes are tied to Earth's environmental history. We can only understand macroevolution, the comings and goings of species and higher taxa through time, if we link the microevolutionary processes studied by geneticists with Earth's dynamic environmental history. The great physical events that framed early animal evolution, global glaciation, the rise of oxygen-filled oceans, and extraordinary perturbations of the carbon cycle, are among our planet's most profound environmental events. We ignore them at our peril. And here, with the seeds of modern biology planted, my narrative ends. The Cambrian explosion, both the culmination of life's long Precambrian history and a radical departure from it, emerges as the product of unique interactions between biological and physical processes. The developmental toolkit built by the duplication, mutation, and rearrangement of genes was necessary for animal diversification, but it likely came together at least 600 million years ago and, by itself, could not complete the biological revolution. The new biology required permissive ecology so that unusual genetic variants could survive, and surviving variants to provide the raw material for morphological innovation. In the great physical upheavals that ended the Proterozoic eon, genetic possibility and environmental opportunity together spawned new and diverse ecosystems in the world's oceans. More broadly, Earth's long Precambrian history provides illuminating perspective on the great idea of 21st century Earth science, that biology is inexorably linked with tectonics and climate, atmosphere and oceans in a complex and interactive Earth surface system. The pageant of Cambrian evolution simply provides one last and dramatic confirmation that life did not evolve on a passive planetary platform. Rather, life and environment evolved together, each influencing the other in building the biosphere we inhabit today. The last word on this history will not be written for many years. At present, we don't really know what processes drove the stepwise growth of oxygen in the atmosphere and oceans. Neither do we understand how and why climates shifted so violently at the beginning and again toward the end of the Proterozoic eon. And we can only conjecture how these and other events shaped, and were shaped by, biology. We have some leads, some good ideas, and much more data than we had a decade ago, but no resolution. The absence of a definitive punchline may disappoint some listeners, but as a paleontologist, it is why I get up in the morning. For scientists, unanswered questions are like Everest's unclimbed, an irresistible lure for restless minds.